On Tech News Today, the NSA denies faking Facebook. A BitTorrent service called Popcorn Time emerges, goes away, and then emerges again. We'll tell you why. And we'll also detail Apple's upcoming HealthBook app. All that and more coming up next.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Tech News Today is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
It's Monday, March 17th, 2014, and this is Tech News Today. This episode of Tech News Today is brought to you by Personal Capital. With Personal Capital, you'll finally have all your financial life in one place and get a clear view of everything you own. Best of all, it's free. To sign up, go to personalcapital.com/TNT. And by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website or online portfolio. For a free two-week trial and 10% off, go to squarespace.com and use the offer code TNT. Welcome to Tech News Today. I'm Mike Elgin.
And I'm Jason Howell.
On Tech News Today, we explore the big stories of the day in conversation with some of the world's best journalists. Our guest co-anchor today is Harry McCracken, editor-at-large for Time, who writes the Technologizer blog. Welcome, Harry.
Hey, guys. Good to be with you again.
It's great to have you, as always. And today, we're having a Google Drive outage of sorts. Google Chat, Google Drive, and Google Docs spreadsheets are all down, possibly for not all users, but definitely for all users here at Twit. So we are suffering through this outage because we use the Google Docs spreadsheet for all of our internal communication. So this is like going back to the pre-Docs days when hardly anything was in the cloud. Well, let's get right to the news. We told you Wednesday about a story on The Intercept that said the NSA is spreading malware by using fake Facebook servers. The NSA subsequently denied it, and this morning, The Intercept's Ryan Gallagher posted an intriguing piece contrasting NSA denials against the details of leaked documents, which, of course, are part of the trove leak by NSA whistleblower Edward Snowden. Ryan Gallagher, of course, writes for The Intercept and joins us today to talk about his story. Welcome, Ryan.
Hi, Mike. Thanks for having me on.
Great to have you. And before we talk about the denials and your piece this morning, can you first summarize this particular revelation as it was reported on The Intercept last week?
Yeah, well, I mean, the story is a very detailed story, but the crux of it is that the NSA has, in the past 10 years, with the assistance of some of its allies, including the United Kingdom, been kind of aggressively scaling up its use of kind of hacking methods and malware to infiltrate computers for surveillance. And so our story just focused on that and a whole bunch of things related to that. But the essence of it is they've really radically scaled up these methods in the past decade.
As I understand it, they've essentially industrialized or sort of mass-produced the ability to spread malware around using a variety of tactics. The tactics themselves sound to me like the typical way you spread malware, but they seem to do it at a much larger scale, or at least have the ability to do it on a much larger scale. Is that your understanding as well?
Yeah, well, I mean, they use a lot of methods that people have associated for years with sort of criminal groups, you know, like phishing tactics where they put a link in an email. But, you know, as the years have gone by, people have been such to those methods, so they've developed more sophisticated techniques. And the distinction between what the NSA is able to do and what, you know, your ordinary criminal group will be able to do is that the NSA has all these covert accesses to the internet backbone, and they can exploit that access to do all kinds of packet injection tactics, as they're called, where they will basically spoof, they'll send malicious data packets to someone and it looks as if they're coming from a legitimate source. For instance, Facebook is one of those examples where they send these malicious data packets as if they're coming from a legitimate Facebook server, which tricks the targeted computer into accepting them, and then NSA can then use that as a sort of platform to deploy its malware. So they have all kinds of different methods, but yeah, some of them are definitely the same as more traditional kind of hacking techniques that have been associated with criminal groups.
So so you reported it, and then they denied it. Who denied this exactly, and what exactly did they deny?
Yeah, well, it's interesting because really what they denied, they denied a lot of things we didn't even report. So they just sort of put this denial out, they just sort of put this denial out there saying we deny it. But then when you look at what they've actually denied, we didn't report these things. So they said the NSA has not infected millions of computers with malware. We never said that. What we reported that they've infected up to 100,000 computers with malware, and they've built a system to be capable of deploying millions of these implants, as they call them. So that was the first thing. But they also denied what we'd reported about them masquerading as a Facebook server in order to do these attacks. And their denial said, we do not impersonate the US company website, but their own document explicitly says that they pretend to be the Facebook server. So it's unclear to me whether they're being very sort of slippery by using the word website instead of server, whether there's some kind of distinction they're making there. But either way, the denial they put out was astonishingly misleading.
Well, they also denied that they're currently doing it, but they didn't deny that they did it in the past. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. And it's another thing where you wonder, are they actually doing that? Have they deliberately used the sort of present tense as opposed to past tense? So they do this often where they sort of, they'll use a word that is very sort of carefully defined, but only they really understand this definition of it and how they're interpreting it. They don't actually tell people how they're interpreting these words in the language that they use. And I think this is a kind of classic case where they have really put this sort of incredibly carefully worded statement out. But when you actually look at it in detail, you see that it's quite devious how they've done it. And certainly when you just need to look at what the documents say compared with their own denial, and it's pretty clear for anyone to see, I think, how sort of slippery they're being with it.
Now, Harry, this story has been with us for a while, and these leaks just keep coming out one after another. They seem to be coming from presentation, PowerPoint presentations, all kinds of other types of ordinary workaday documents, and they seem to have a kind of air, at least to me, of bragging. Here's what we can do. Here's what we can do. And it's not clear to me the difference, the distance between what they say they can do or what somebody within the organization said they could do in some document that's been leaked on the one hand and what they've actually done on the other hand. Do you have an overall sense or any thoughts on this issue about the distance between what they say they can do and what they've actually done? I'm sorry. Go ahead, Harry.
Sure. One thing that's amazed me about all these revelations is the degree to which they put a lot of stuff down on paper, some of which does feel like bragging. Presumably, if they documented this stuff and then issue a denial later, the denial is going to be very carefully tuned to perhaps be accurate only in a very technical sense. But it's amazing to me that so much of this stuff was written down in the first place.
Yeah, absolutely. And Ryan, you of course write for The Intercept, which is a site that exists to uncover these revelations from the Snowden documents. How does that work exactly? Are you being fed new documents because you come up with new stories, or did somebody come in with a forklift with just like all these documents, and then you have a staff of like unpaid interns, like furiously going through these things and uncovering them as they go? How does that work?
Oh, we just have there's a lot of documents that it's already been publicly discussed by Glenn Greenwald and others that there was an awful lot of these documents, so it takes a lot of time just to go through them, and so that's just what we've been doing for months now. Just trying to go through these documents and story by story getting them out. But it takes the thing is, they often they're very technical, and each story takes a lot of time to report, so that's why we're investing a lot of time in it. But yeah, we have sort of just methods to go through the documents, and we definitely have a lot more stories still to do, I think.
Well, I appreciate your story this morning and also the stories that you've covered on this issue over the last week, and also all of the uncovered documents that you've explored on the Intercept. And I thank you for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. Appreciate that.
All right. You can find Sean's work at firstlook.org and on Twitter at RJ_Gallagher, GALLAGHER. Well, in a sec, we're going to talk about exciting new developments in the world of mobile gaming. But first, I want to tell you about Personal Capital. Personal Capital is one of our sponsors today, and they can help you get your financial life in order so you can get ahead with your money. There are two barriers to growing your wealth, basically. The first barrier is that it's hard to keep track of all of your stuff, all of your investments, your 401k, your stocks, your bank accounts, all of your financial data spread out all over the internet and in different places. And the second is you probably pay somebody to manage your money, and you're probably paying way too much, certainly more than necessary. Personal Capital brings all your accounts and assets into one single screen on your computer so you can look at everything with an intuitive charts and graphs that make sense and that you can wrap your head around so you can make smarter decisions. It shows you how much you're overpaying in fees. It also shows you how to reduce those fees, which is really great. You can also get tailored advice on optimizing your investment. So why wait? Signing up takes just a minute. It'll pay big dividends. And best of all, it's free. And so you're not going to waste any money, not a penny, by getting your financial house in order. To set up your free account, go to personalcapital.com/TNT. And remember that Personal Capital is free and the smart way to grow your money. But you must go to personalcapital.com/TNT to see this incredible service. That's personalcapital.com/TNT. And by using that URL, you'll support Tech News Today. And we thank Personal Capital for their support of this show. Well, Google announced this morning that it's bringing Google Play game services to the iOS platform. The change will enable gamers with Android and iOS devices to play against each other. I'm sure they'll appreciate that. And with us to discuss this is Dean Takahashi, who's a games writer for GamesBeat at VentureBeat. Welcome, Dean.
Hello. Hi, Mike.
Hey. So what did Google announce this morning?
They announced some enhancements to the Google Play Store that are going to make it much easier for developers to really sort of get noticed. The big problem on Google Play and on iOS is that there's a million other apps out there, and if you can't get your game in front of the right gamer, then that's a huge problem. You're going to get lost. And so discovery is something Google's trying to address today by making it much easier for gamers to do things like gift each other virtual items in games, and that helps lead to better discovery. There's better multiplayer services across platforms. We're also creating 18 new categories in the store so that when you search for things, you can actually find the kind of games you want better. So those are all things in the name of allowing more commerce. And it's also just sort of part of this recognition that mobile gaming is so huge.
Well, Dean, are you at the Game Developers Conference in San Francisco right now?
Yes, I am.
Okay, yes, your connection's a little spotty. I think we can get through. It's good enough, but I just wanted to point out that you are on the scene at the Game Developers Conference covering the announcements today around gaming all over the place. So was this move expected? Did you expect Google to announce this week?
I didn't necessarily expect it. They usually do a lot of sort of full court press for game developers at the GDC. They're in competition with Apple. They want to get the best developers on their platform, so they usually do something. I didn't expect this in particular. The good thing is that it shows that Google cares about the gaming industry, even as large as it is. It's this recognition that mobile games are a $12 billion worldwide industry now. There's a billion Android devices that have been activated, and something like 3 out of 4 Android users actually play games.
Interesting. Now, Harry, do you see a world coming up very soon where mobile gaming is all cross-platform on every platform?
Well, we always sort of seem to be on the cusp of something like that. It hasn't quite gotten here yet. And one of the interesting things about the dynamics between Apple and Google with iOS and Android is that Apple has the most robust gaming platform right now, and they have very little incentive to reach out to Android users. But Google, because they're running behind and because they're less of a hardware company and more of a web services company, has every reason to reach out in the other direction to iOS users. And so this might give them a little bit of a step up compared to Apple, who doesn't have to work quite as hard to find a large quorum of game users.
Yeah, and it's certainly consistent with other app categories. Google often releases apps on iOS that are earlier and often better than on the Android platform for one reason or another. So they are definitely committed to cross-platform everything, as far as I can tell. Dean, when does this become available for developers, and when do you expect games to actually come out that support cross-platform gaming?
They're really just sort of releasing the software development kit and updating it this week and training developers on how to do these things. And so that's probably going to take they're going to be a part of works in progress from now going forward. So we're definitely see it this year, but how soon, I'm not exactly sure yet.
Okay, wonderful. Well, thank you for joining us today, Dean. I appreciate you coming on.
All right, thank you.
All right, you can find Dean Takahashi at GamesBeat, at VentureBeat, and also on Twitter at Dean Tak. That's DeanTak. Well, a service called Popcorn Time, which lets you watch pirated BitTorrent movies for free, became available last week. Then it was shut down. Now it's back. It's kind of a complicated story because the people who shut it down are different from the people who brought it back. With us to discuss this is Devendra Hardawar, a senior editor and lead mobile writer for VentureBeat. Welcome, Devendra.
Hey, guys. Thanks for having me.
First of all, can you tell us what Popcorn Time is and who created it?
Sure. It's basically a sort of Netflix version it's like Netflix. It gives you access to BitTorrent movies. So in the past, you'd have to like find a BitTorrent site, open up your BitTorrent client, wait for things to start downloading before you could actually watch a movie. This just streamlined the entire experience in a really interesting way. And it was developed by some developers in Argentina. I'm not sure if they actually publicly like admitted who they are and who exactly is working there, but it's a really just really cool, good-looking, well-designed app. I think it's just an interesting experiment, not something that I'd recommend everybody do because, yeah, piracy, not so great.
And why did they shut it down? Did scary Hollywood jackbooted thugs come crashing through their door, or did they just get scared, or was there some other reason?
I'm sure that was probably part of it. In their farewell letter, they said that they checked to make sure the project itself is legal because, you know, the software is just hooking into all these BitTorrent servers and processing these things and giving people access to the movies. It's really the act of downloading and sharing the movies. It's really illegal. But I'm sure some Hollywood studios just raised ruckus and threatened these guys. It makes a lot of sense for it to be shut down. It seems more like an experiment for these developers to prove that they can create this thing than an actual long-lasting project. And I think that's kind of how they were talking about it from the start.
So who brought it back?
It's YTS. They're a BitTorrent database website, basically. And, you know, I think they're far less afraid of the consequences just because they've been dealing in the murky world of BitTorrent for a while. So they brought it back. The installer came back yesterday, and now you can re-download it from the new site at YTS. And it works just as much as it did before. And honestly, it's surprising how well it works. It'll be really interesting to see what they do with this.
Now, YTS claimed that it's a community project. They said, like, well, this isn't us, just us. This is like for the whole community.
Yeah.
Why did they say that as a kind of a defensive move, or are they just trying to clarify the fact that this is something that's sort of this widespread project that other organizations can get involved with?
I think it's more just to open it up to the internet and to any developer who really wants to pitch in. The project is up on GitHub now. Which is where, you know, most open source projects go for people to share and interact with code and stuff. I think it shows this is kind of what YTS does. They tend to adopt projects like this and try to get everybody involved. I think the internet in general, developers really want to show off what they can do in really interesting ways. And having a cool app like this, maybe being able to give it new features or do other things with it, would be a really cool way to show off your skills, basically.
Fantastic. Well, I want to thank you for coming on and explaining this.
No problem. It's a really, it's a crazy app, given how easily it works. But yeah, no problem, guys.
Very quickly, you said it was a crazy app. In what way is it crazy? Is it other than just the fact that it's really functional and well-designed?
It's really, it just, it works as advertised, which is something you can't even say for like Flickster. You know, there was Veronica Mars Kickstarter this week and everybody had trouble with that. I was able to launch Popcorn Time, hit a button and see American Hustle in HD within 15 seconds. And I was even able to skip around the movie to different time points, which is just, I can't imagine how they're working this because you're still getting the BitTorrent file. You don't have the whole file. It's really kind of amazing to me. Mm.
That is incredible. Well, thanks for coming on and telling us about this.
No problem. Thanks, guys.
All right. You can find Devendra at VentureBeat.com, excuse me, and on Twitter at Devendra, D-E-V-I-N-D-R-A. Well, Apple's working on an iOS application that will almost certainly ship with iOS and may be called HealthBook. This passbook-like app will apparently focus on fitness tracking and healthcare monitoring. 9to5 Mac's Mark Gurman posted a detailed analysis, the best coverage of this app by far that I've seen online. And he published it this morning. He joins us now to fill us in. Oh, welcome, Mark.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Glad you're here. What is HealthBook and what will it be able to do?
So HealthBook is an application for the iPhone that Apple has been developing. And I first detailed it in January. It would be a application with several different cards, kind of like a on Passbook, but instead of like movie tickets and boarding passes, it's your vital signs and different fitness statistics. So you'll have like a blood work folder to check glucose levels, one to check blood sugar, which is glucose, folder talking about nutrition, sleep tracking, the activity tag. The one tab in orange is mostly like a pedometer. It tells you steps, calories burned, miles walked. And then there's some more interesting stuff that a lot of companies haven't really tackled in the tech space, such as blood pressure, respiratory rate, oxygen saturation, heart rate, all sorts of stuff. So it's really expansive and advanced.
The thing that jumped out to me when I saw this is, where are they getting this data? I mean, how are they measuring hydration levels? How are they measuring some of the stuff, the glucose levels? Obviously, it's not going to be just the iPhone here.
Right. That's the million-dollar question. So I think there's four different possibilities about where data can come from. The first would be the iPhone itself. The M7 could, you know, in the new iPhone 5S and iPad Air could technically work like a pedometer and tell you steps and calories and all that. Other information can come from the whole ecosystem of iPhone-connected health accessories. There's Wi-Fi-enabled scales on the market. There's Bluetooth blood pressure checkers, there's devices that can measure your glucose levels. But, you know, as you said, hydration, oxygen, respiratory rate, that's some really advanced stuff that hasn't really been done before. So the answer to that question is probably a future Apple wearable device. We know that Apple's working on an iWatch with advanced medical sensors. So it's probably very likely that that watch will be able to fill in the gaps that the existing accessories on the market and the iPhone chips can't do itself.
Now, Harry, you've been following Apple for a long time, and I'm sure you've been following the wearables and also the fact that Apple has been hiring people in the medical area. Does this whole app scream to you of an iWatch that's going to be sensing biometric data?
Well, when Mark reports something about Apple, I take it a lot more seriously than I do when many sites report about Apple. So, it kind of makes sense. You know, it seems like for a long time now, we've been sitting around thinking that Apple is probably working on something wearable. But one of the challenges about figuring out wearable stuff is so much of it doesn't quite make sense. It's not clear why Apple would want to put something on your wrist. We have not seen a smartwatch from another company that really feels like it could be the next iPod. But this health stuff is really important. And it is an area where if Apple chose to, they could do things that nobody has done yet. And there do seem to be some, you know, pieces of the puzzle in place that indicate they might be working on something in this area. It rings true in a way that some of the other possible wearable stuff has not.
It absolutely does. And it's kind of stunning because we started hearing about smartwatches, you know, a few years ago, and everybody expected them to be sort of notifications, the same thing that shows up on your phone, on your closed screen and so on. And it's kind of veering toward this sort of medical thing. The coolest watch coming out of Samsung, for example, looks to be one of these bracelets rather than a big wristwatch. And we started hearing that Apple was getting very serious about, you know, people always categorized it as a kind of quantified self thing. But this is hardcore medical equipment that they're talking about here, blood sugar level, and, you know, this sounds like life-saving applications for diabetics and things like that. It's kind of astonishing to see them go into this kind of hardcore medical stuff because, of course, Apple is in the business of very widespread mainstream type of devices. Harry, what do you think? Is this a surprising left turn into the world of medicine for Apple?
Well, I mean, already the iPhone has become a really interesting device for medical stuff, and you've seen lots and lots of startups and sometimes big companies use it as a portal for health stuff, not mm-hmm. just doing stuff like blood sugar, but also hearing aids that are tweaked to work well with an iPhone. I mean, it is potentially a huge business in a way that a smartwatch doesn't feel like it's a huge business on its own. I also think it's intriguing that Apple looks like it's building a really robust iPhone application to serve as the interface. Because one question I always have about any kind of wearable is Apple likes to do beautiful screens, and Apple also likes to give you long battery life. That's a huge challenge with a wearable device. And I sort of wonder whether this might be an indication that instead of doing the beautiful interface on the wearable device itself, it's going to let the iPhone be the beautiful screen and the device just be the data collector.
Yeah. So, Mark, I'm intrigued by the fact that this app appears to need third-party support, pretty widespread third-party support from all kinds of hardware and software makers, all kinds of sensor devices and so on. But I'm also intrigued by some of these things which appear to be doable by the iPhone itself without help from third parties. One of them, for example, is the sleep monitor. There are ways to do that. I think there's a real possibility that they're going to figure out a way for the iPhone to listen to you snoring or something like that and figure out what your sleep cycles are. What do you think? Is a lot of this going to be done by the iPhone by itself?
Right. So I think there's a bunch of functionality there, like I said, in terms of the pedometer tracking, like you said, with the sleep, that could be done with the iPhone hardware already in your pocket. But if you look at that application, there is a whole, you know, sort of different health and fitness statistics that are going to be tracked by HealthBook that certainly can't be done with by the iPhone. And there's also ones that certainly can't be done by any existing accessories. So there's that hole there where the theory breaks, where you have to have something to step in. Because, you know, if Apple's building the software for something, they're also, you know, looking for the hardware side. Because that application does absolutely nothing if it doesn't have the hardware to make it happen, whether that hardware is in an iPhone, on, you know, Apple's online store where they're selling a bunch of iPhone connected fitness accessories, or an Apple bracelet or iWatch, that's to be seen. But I think the picture is very clear at this point that they're moving towards the health and fitness direction, and they're going to do it in a way that's really going to destroy the market. And about your point earlier about Apple entering the medical space, you know, right now it kind of seems niche to have a hospital on your wrist, but, you know, there was a time where tablets were very niche as well. There was a time where having a computer in your pocket was unthinkable. There was a time where people were carrying out CD players and MP3 players were just 15 songs in this huge little box. So just like Apple transformed those industries, I think that the next big insight could be transforming, you know, society and the health industry. So I think it's time for the next big thing, and I think it's pretty clear what that's going to be from Apple.
Well, thank you for coming on Tech News today, Mark. I appreciate your story, and everybody should go read it because it's very, very detailed and very thorough, and I appreciate that.
Thanks so much.
All right, you can find Mark at 9to5Mac.com and also on Twitter at Mark Gurman. His last name is spelled G-U-R-M-A-N. Well, in a sec, we're going to give you the latest follow-up on one Satoshi Nakamoto, but first I want to tell you about Squarespace. Squarespace is an incredible site that helps you build a website that is not just good, not just great, but spectacular. And how do they do that? They do it starting with fantastic design. They have more than 25 beautiful templates for you to start with. You simply go in there, choose a template, and then you can modify it to your heart's content. If you don't like it or want something else, you can go try another one. It's very, very easy to do. It's so easy that you can do a lot of trial and error. I really like that. If you have a small business, if you're building something, if you want to sell something online, they have two ways to help you. One of them is that they support e-commerce for all subscription plan levels, so you can actually take money via your website, and Squarespace will make it super easy for you to do that. The second is a logo creator tool, which you can check out at blog.squarespace.com. This tool, if you think you're not a designer, you should think again, because this tool will help you create a beautiful logo, which you can trademark and use permanently as your logo for your small business. It's a really incredible design for this tool, and you should try it out. even if you're just kicking the tires here, go try out this logo tool because this is really a cool service. Now, Squarespace sounds really expensive, but it's really not. It starts at just $8 a month, and that includes a free domain name if you sign up for a year. And Squarespace, importantly, is mobile ready. They have a Squarespace metric app for iPhone and iPad that lets you check all your site stats and unique visitors, social media followers, and that sort of thing. And they have a blog app that helps you maintain and manage and deal with the blog comments that you have, which is very important. You can do that on the go with the mobile device. Even their code is beautiful. Of course, hosting is included. Squarespace takes care of the hosting, so you don't have to. So start a free 2-week trial with no credit card required and start building your website today. When you decide to sign up for Squarespace, make sure you use the offer code TNT. That'll get you 10% off the price and also show your support for Tech News Today. And we thank Squarespace for their support of Tech News Today. And remember that a better web awaits, and it starts with your new Squarespace website. Well, Dorian Satoshi Nakamoto, who we told you in previous episodes was identified by Newsweek as being the creator of Bitcoin, has gotten himself a lawyer, has officially denied involvement in the cryptocurrency. In a statement today, he said, quote, "I did not create, invent, or otherwise work on Bitcoin. I unconditionally deny the Newsweek report." I also assume he'll be canceling his subscription to Newsweek. Well, in other news, two engineers in England destroyed the Rubik's Cube record with a robot they made with Lego. The CubeStormer 3 robot solved Rubik's Cube in 3.253 seconds, shattering the old record of 5.55 seconds. The robot is made with a few Lego Mindstorm sets, and it's powered by a custom-made Android app running on a Samsung Galaxy S4. Let's hear it for the Samsung side. It took Mike Dobson and David Gilday a year and a half to build a robot. Gilday, by the way, works for ARM, the chip people. What do you think about that one, Harry? That was an impressive video. That thing just rips through the Rubik's Cube. I mean, why do Rubik's Cube when you can have a robot do it for you?
I'm not sure if I've ever solved Rubik's Cube. And 30 years ago, I spent a lot of time trying to solve it. So it is amazing. And Mindstorms in general is just an amazing platform. You can lose a lot of time on the web just looking around and seeing the stuff people are doing with it.
That's why I don't go anywhere near any of that stuff, because I just don't have the time to build robots to solve Rubik's Cube. I'd rather just, it's much easier to just ignore the whole thing, all of it. But I do appreciate the video. So that's a really awesome project. Well, I want to thank you, Harry, for coming on Tech News Today and sharing your insights with us.
It was fun. Thanks, guys.
All right. You can find Harry on Twitter at Harry McCracken and, of course, at time.com. Well, I want you to subscribe to Tech News Today if you haven't already. You can subscribe to the audio version or the video version at our website at twit.tv/TNT. You can subscribe to our YouTube channel at youtube.com/Tech News Today. You can also follow us on Twitter, Tech News Today TV, no spaces there. You can also join our Google Plus community and circle our Google Plus page by searching for Tech News Today on G+. And you can subscribe to our subreddit at technewstoday.reddit.com. Leave us voicemail by calling 260-TNT-SHOW. And also don't miss our evening newscast, Tech News Tonight, at 4 p.m. Pacific every weeknight. My name is Mike Elgin, and I thank you for tuning in. We'll see you tomorrow.